Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Kokyo. I've met quite a few of you before, but probably not all of you. It's good to be back in Sacramento. Thanks for your devotion, coming out to sit for the day. Most important thing we can do for the world is to stop like this and remember who we are and why we're here. The topic for today is an old Zen story. In the Koan collection, the Wumen Guan, Japanese, the Mumon Kan, in English, the Gateless Barrier, collection of old Zen stories. And case 23 in this collection is about the sixth ancestor. And I know some of you here have been studying the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. Maybe you finished?
Yeah.
So this story might sound familiar. And it's a little bit unusual because sometimes these koan stories are just very short and concise, but this one's like a half page long, basically just extracted from the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. Called Huainong, that's the name of the sixth ancestor. Huainong is neither good nor bad. So it's a little excerpt from the autobiography of the sixth ancestor told in the Platform Sutra. So many great stories in there. For those who don't know the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, I recommend it. It's one of the classic treatises of Zen. It's unusual to call a Zen text a sutra, right? That's like a scripture of the Buddha. But this one has that name, the Platform Sutra, taught on a platform. Maybe kind of like this one. And the sixth Chinese ancestor in Zen. This is like the 7th century. Bodhidharma was the first ancestor. And so there's more of the background story here, but I'm not going to tell you all that. You can read the Platform Sutra. But maybe to summarize the story up to where this koan starts is... that the one who became the sixth ancestor, Huainong, was supposedly an illiterate woodcutter. And he heard a line from a sutra of the Buddha in the marketplace. He kind of overheard somebody reciting a sutra and had a kind of awakening. And then thought, I've got to go study Zen to find out more about this. So he did. But because he was an illiterate woodcutter, he didn't sit with the monks in the Zendo, but he just sifted the rice in the kitchen storehouse, supposedly, but practicing diligently during this time. And at some point, the fifth ancestor wanted to find a successor and pass on his teaching. He was retiring, so... people thought it would be one of those monks who'd been practicing in the Zendo for many years would be the successor of the fifth ancestor. But instead, he made this illiterate woodcutter his successor. Who would have known? So, and there's, you know, there's more details of this story you can read in the sutra, but maybe we could say that's part of that story is showing that it doesn't matter necessarily if you practice for many, many years doing a lot of zazen. You could just be a newcomer that just devotedly like sifts the rice, and what's most important is this clarity, this realizing our true nature and trusting that clearly. At least that's how it seemed for the fifth ancestor. That was important. So that's part of our Zen heritage. It's like it doesn't necessarily take time, but time is helpful because we live in the world of time. So even if we feel quite clear about who we are, it's good to give it time. It's good to keep practicing again and again and again, endlessly. And the sixth ancestor, he became the sixth ancestor kind of quickly, but then he kept practicing. In fact, the story, the later part of the story, is that after he left the fifth ancestor, he thought, before I go out and start spreading the good news of this Dharma, I should just practice for some time because I haven't been practicing so long. So he just apparently just hung out in the forest for, I think it was like 6 years or something. He didn't practice in the Zen monasteries. He just lived in the woods with a band of hunters, kind of incognito. He was the fifth ancestor of Chinese Zen, all the Zen lineages and millions of practitioners since his time all flow forth from the sixth ancestor. But he just like lived out in the woods with the hunters while he was kind of like nurturing the sacred embryo of his insight. And one version of the story says, the hunters would, kill some animals and they'd make this big stew and they'd throw some greens from the forest in there too, but the sixth ancestor would skip the meat and he would just eat the greens from the stew. That's part of the story too. So anyway, this part of the story is he's the fifth ancestor secretly transmitted the robe and the bowl of Bodhidharma to the sixth ancestor. That was the symbolic transmission of this new Zen movement. The robe and the bowl. And he did it kind of secretly at midnight, I think mainly because he knew it would be like controversial that this illiterate woodcutter would become the sixth ancestor. The fifth ancestor felt it was a good thing to do this way, but he's like, it's going to cause a stir, and let's just like do it kind of low key. But of course, the monks in the assembly found out the next day, and they thought, this is wrong, even though our teacher said this is what he wanted to do. We don't agree. Let's go get the robe and bowl of Bodhidharma back and do this thing right. Maybe our teacher is getting senile and was just having a bad day or something. Crazy, crazy old teacher. We'll take this matter into our own hands. The Kupa monks wanted to go chase him down, the sixth ancestor. And so they did. Somehow they followed his footsteps and they found him on a Tai Yu peak. And this is where the koan, case 23, in the Gavis barrier, comes in telling this story. It says, the sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Tai Yu peak. The ancestor, seeing Ming coming, took out the robe and bowl, because remember that's what he knew, they were kind of coming after the robe and bowl. Symbolic material representations of the Zen lineage, right? So he took the robe and bowl and he put them on a rock, and he hid behind the rock. And Ming, the head monk, and this band of angry monks came, they saw the robe and bowl on the rock, the six ancestors said something like, this robe represents the Dharma. We shouldn't fight over it. So if you want to take it, you take it back. I don't want to fight with you about the Dharma. And Ming tried to lift up the robe and bowl, but they wouldn't budge. They were as immovable as a mountain. And shivering and trembling, he said, unable to pick them up, he snapped out of his kind of jealous anger and said, actually, I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, illiterate woodcutter, but Dharma brother, please open the way for me. This is all told in this long koan story. And six ancestors said to him, since he was now at this point open, which was important, he would never have said this if the head monk didn't say, I came for the Dharma, please teach me. If he said, just give me the robe, he would never have heard this teaching, but he was humble and open enough to say, please teach me, actually. So the ancestor said to the head monk, without thinking of good or bad, what is your original face? That's the center of the koan, the point of the koan. Without thinking of good, bad, right, wrong, this, that, high, low, right, left, without thinking of all these dualistic concerns, just let them rest for the moment. Not saying that there is no good and bad, it's just for the time being, if you want to open the way, then for the time being, just let your thoughts of good and bad and right and wrong and all of this stuff, just let them rest. And once you let them rest, then ask yourself deeply, what is my original face? And then later versions of this question were kind of expanded to sometimes say, what is your original face before your mother and father were born? Just to emphasize, like, it's not the face just, you know, when you walked into the room or something. Original face is not even before you were born, but before your mother and father, before your aunt and uncle, before your nephew and niece. Another set of opposites, right? Before your mother and father, before male and female were born, what is your original face? And instantly, the head monk, in his open-hearted presence, instantly, when he asked himself this question deeply and sincerely, he had a great awakening, great satori, great realization. And sweat ran from his entire body. That's the first half of the story. Maybe we'll leave the second half for this afternoon, since we have another talk. Yeah, but that's the main part, the main point, the center of this koan. It didn't need to have all the story around it. It could the koan could just be, without thinking good or bad, what is your original face? That's our koan for today. You can sit with this question. And that was in the 7th century in old China. That's how they spoke of it. And for a kind of modern, maybe kind of commentary or modern approach to this koan, seems to me, what I'm going to bring up is not, strictly speaking, commenting on this story, but it's closely related. And this is a teaching called The Headless Way. Does anybody know Douglas Harding and The Headless Way? A couple people. Yeah. I think he wrote this book in the early 60s, so maybe it's kind of outdated, or people feel that it's not so known anymore. I don't know if it was even popular at the time. It's a little bit strange. I think the book, he was a British philosopher, maybe, Douglas Harding, and his first book was called On Having No Head. And the subtitle is Zen and the Rediscovery of the Obvious. And I would say that's what Zen is about, is the rediscovery of the obvious. And so he was, Douglas Harding was not a Zen practitioner, but he discovered one time that he had no head. And the way he discovered this was, and then taught it. And then his students who are still teaching the Headless Way, with these kind of like exercises. So if you indulge me in this exercise, which is a way to kind of open the way of this koan, it involves using your finger, because finger is kind of pointer. In Zen, they knew about fingers, right? And they say, I think the Lankavatara Sutra says, don't mistake the finger that's pointing at the moon for the moon. Right? Like all these teachings, all these Dharma teachings are like fingers pointing at the moon of reality. So we're directed to look at where the finger is pointing towards the moon, but not get too caught up in the finger. So that goes for this exercise too, the Headless Way exercise. We use a finger, but it's just a pointer. So, because that's how we usually point. So, if you wouldn't mind, take out a finger, any finger you'd like, as a pointer. And then it helps to actually do this exercise with a finger, I think. You don't really need to, but that's how it was taught, and I think it's helpful. Because what you're using the finger for, it's a pointer. So you look kind of down the finger at where it's pointing to. And you can start with pointing kind of down at an angle like this, wherever you're pointing to. And then the exercise is to ask, what do you experience visually? This is kind of a visual exercise. What do you see at the end of the finger? We might say, very, very simply, and staying with our direct experience without imagining what we should be seeing, we just say, well, something we call a floor. Most people are pointing at a floor, but you could say more specifically, it's like a kind of a beige color, and it has a kind of texture, sort of like lumpy texture, and it's a flat surface. And it's kind of not that even a color, maybe it's sort of smudged foot oil from years of Zen people walking on it. So pretty simple, right? That's the first thing. We're looking at what we actually see at the end of the finger. Then move the finger kind of like this, point down. And now what do you see at the end of the finger? You see some legs, right? You see, you have to look down the finger. What's the finger point to? We say it's some human legs, like a lap of a person, right? And it has a particular shape. Each person's lap is gonna look a little bit different, a different shape and color depending on what you're wearing. But that's what we see there. It's a shape and color that we call legs. Then keep turning your finger like this. And now like this, right? Now what do you see at the end of the finger? You kind of have to tuck your chin in to like do this part, right? So you see like a torso of a human seen from a very oblique angle. So you can't see much of it, but it's kind of like, you can see it's again, it's got a color and a shape, and it's like a human torso, right? That's what's at the end of the finger. Now move your finger up like this and point at what is looking. And what do you see there? If you say, oh, it's my face, say, then we're not staying with our direct experience. That's just an idea that there's a face or a head there, right? Experientially, there's no head or face, right? This is the headless way. This is on having no head. The rediscovery that actually we really don't have a head. We can't see any head there. So, but what is it? What is it that we see at the end of the finger, right? Isn't it kind of like a sort of a like a circular, maybe not even circular, but kind of like a window, a big window that if we look around the edges of the window, we can't look in all directions, but the edge of the window, we can't really see the frame either. The edge of the window kind of blurs into like nothingness. Can you see that window? It's like basically where there was a head, there's like an empty window. But it's not just a blank, empty window, right? It's filled with this room and all these people. Can you follow that exercise? Did you have great Satori? I think that you could say it's a silly little exercise, but at the same time, I think it's quite profound. If you really, the trick is not to jump to any assumptions or conceptual ideas about our face or head, but stay with direct experience, and then it's kind of like looking back at the looker. We can't see anything there. We don't, all these other objects that we're pointing at have a particular color and shape, right? All the way up to the torso. But this doesn't have a particular color and shape. This kind of window-like space. And yet, this colorless, shapeless space is filled with a whole bunch of colors and shapes. Call a bunch of people sitting in a room with some walls and rug and cabinets and screens and Buddhas. Could it be that this is our original face? This is our original face before mother and father were born. This is just a visual exercise, but one could do it with other senses as well. we might say, well, when I really start exploring this kind of window, if I look to the left, I do see my face. It's something like a nose. And I know the nose is on my face, but we think that the nose is on our face. If we look in a mirror, we've seen that. But if we stay with our direct experience, we look to we close one eye, and we look towards that thing over there we're calling a nose. But isn't it more like the nose is actually not on a face? It kind of extends from the ceiling down to the floor, doesn't it? And actually the nose kind of curves around, and we can't really see the other side, but the nose is kind of like floating in the middle of that window. Isn't it more like that? There's still no evidence for a face there or a head. It's just the edge of a curved nose floating in the empty space of the window. And then there's more exercises that the headless way proposes. So another pointing one. One more, if I can ask for your indulgence in this. This is called two-directional pointing. So you point it at your original face, and then point the other finger out at the room, right? So one finger is pointing to a bunch of colors and shapes and particular things out there, and one's pointing to this open window that has no color and shape, right? So now the question is, well, with these two pointers like that, one is called like an empty space with no color and shape, and one is called a whole bunch of colors and shapes and locations called the room. Now those sound very different, but the question is, where is the dividing line now between the empty original face called this clear window, and then the room that we're sitting in with all these people in? Where is the dividing line between those? They seem very different, right? One's like a remembering. One is it just an empty spacious window, and one's a bunch of stuff? Where does one end and the other begin? Is it right where the two hands meet? No, that's not a dividing line, is it? Can you see? Can you get into this question? There isn't a dividing line, is there? Between your original face and the room? Can you see how there's no division? In Buddha Dharma, we sometimes speak of the two truths, right? There's the conventional truth of appearances. That's the truth that appears to us as like colors and shapes and sounds and particular experiences located in time and space with edges and distinctions and differences. That's the conventional truth, like the room full of people that we're looking at. It's the conventional truth of appearances. And then in Buddha Dharma, we have the ultimate truth, which is more mysterious. It's spoken of as like emptiness, like empty space, with no colors and shapes and distinctions at all, and no differences. That's sometimes how the ultimate truth is described, like our original face. So we could say, what we're seeing at the end of the fingertip experientially, in this case, is kind of like the description of the ultimate truth. You know, like it's an empty space with no distinctions. It's visually actually, even it's like that, right? We have to really stay with our experience here. And then this is like all the differences of color and shape and particularities. So we could say, one finger is pointing at the conventional truth and one is at the ultimate truth. These sound very different. So where's the dividing line between the conventional truth and the ultimate truth? We can't find a dividing line, right? And that's what the teaching says too. The great vehicle, Buddha Dharma, says there's these two truths, conventional truth and ultimate truth. And we can describe them quite differently. They're not synonyms. Some of us have been having a discussion recently about this kind of thing, and somebody's saying, I feel like they're just synonyms. So I've been trying to tell her, they're not really synonyms, because synonyms means like exactly the same. Because one is this array of different colors and shapes and sounds and experiences, and one is like there's no color and shape and experience. You can't call that synonyms, but you also can't really say that they're different. They're not synonyms, but they're not. There's no difference or dividing line between them either. That's how the two truths are. And if you hear that as kind of philosophy, it just sounds like a paradox. But if you put your fingers out like this and look for the dividing line between these two truths, there isn't one, right? Can you follow that? This is like experientially verifying the non-duality of the two truths. It might sound like a kind of a very deep thing, but this is very ordinary. It's just like looking carefully in two directions at once, in a way, which is actually what we're always doing. We're always aware of this window. We can't lose it. This empty window is always with us. And the content of the window, if we close our eyes, then we just have the empty window, and it's a dark window. But as soon as we open our eyes, the window is filled with colors and shapes and appearances, the array of the world of appearances. So we always have both, right? We're living in the conventional truth and the ultimate truth. In this case, we might even say, isn't it that the conventional truth of appearances is appearing in this open, formless, colorless, non-differentiated window? They're inseparable, aren't they? I would propose that this is what the sixth ancestor meant by our original face. And remember, he taught it as, first of all, we have to kind of like relax this part of the mind that's really trying to figure out good and bad and right and wrong. Again, not that those things are not important, but in order to clearly verify our original face, we have to temporarily relax this good and bad thing, because the good and bad thing is basically like looking out at the stuff out there. These smudges on the floor are not so good. We need to do it like a deep clean with one of those professional carpet cleaners, because it's not so good with these smudges, right? But these pillars in the back of the room here, those are awesome, because from ancient times, Zen temples have always had these pillars. It's just like an ancient Chinese Zen temple with these pillars. And then you can comment on them. Like, another one of those koans is like, merge with the pillar. You can't say that kind of thing if you don't have pillars to merge with. So those pillars are great, but the smudges on the rug, could use a deep clean. So now we're into good and bad, and we're basically into the appearances in this window, but we're so into the particularities that we forget the window. So I think that's why he said, just for the time being, just don't get into like the good and bad of the appearances going on here. Just like let that rest in order to discover the obvious, which is your original face. There's no good and bad here at the end of the finger. It's you might say, well, actually, it's great. Isn't this a great kind of like bright, spacious, relaxed, empty place? Isn't that good? Well, that's already kind of like getting into the appearances around it. It really doesn't have any, I think, seems like our original face, when we're really just being our original face. It's really not in the realm of good or bad. It doesn't fall into those categories. And that's why it's so freeing. Again, it's not that there's no good and bad. They're appearing in our original face. But it's so easy to overlook our original face. Why? Because it doesn't look like anything except everything other than itself. And we might say, okay, this is our original face before we got into good and bad, but it's going a little bit too far, isn't it, to say that this is our original face before our parents, before our mother and father were born. Isn't that going a little bit too far? No?
I don't think so, because that's the same thing, because they were human too. It's the same creation.
Yeah, so Oscar says, weren't our parents just like us? If they were to take their fingers and point like that, I mean, first of all, maybe we didn't clarify the point, that when all of us were pointing like this to our faces, did we see something different? You could say, yes, because when some of us were like going like this, so the stuff that was appearing in our original face all looked a little bit different. So that's right, the stuff that appears in our original face always looks a little different. But we're now asking about our actual original face. When we're pointing like this, would we not describe it exactly the same? Isn't that actually what truly unifies us? We might use different words, but isn't that experience of what's at the end of the finger exactly the same for each of us? Some might say, well, my vision is a little more blurry. Jim had just had cataract surgery. Is your vision clear now?
It's getting there.
So some might feel like the finger looks really blurry for me. But if we're describing, remember we say, don't mistake the finger for the moon. Our original face is another name for the moon of reality. So we're not talking about whether the finger is clear or blurry. That's just the finger. Our original face is not blurry or clear, right? I mean, we can close our eyes completely and it doesn't go anywhere. It's just that now there's nothing, it's not, all this stuff is filling our face. Still the same original face. And wouldn't it be the case, I mean, it's almost like, it's an imagination that we're doing, but it seems like pretty clear, it would be pretty hard to argue that imagining if our mother and father were to look at their original face, it must be exactly the same as ours now. But again, the elaborated version of the koans is, we're not asking about our mothers and fathers' original faith. We're saying before our mother and father were born, what was our original faith? These crazy Zen people talk like that. But, and we might say, that's this crazy Zen talk. But actually, okay, before our parents were born, they were our grandparents. You can imagine our grandparents looking back at their face and discovering the obvious, that they have no head. And, okay, but that's just our grandparents. What about before that? Well, our great-grandparents. What about before there were humans? We're going way back. Before there were humans on this planet, what if some other apes were to look back at their original face? Wouldn't they find the same one? What about before the apes? Going back, back, back. What were those first species, like some sort of centipede-like things under the ocean, or I don't know. Far back, some kind of fish, I think, water creatures, right? And the fish have these eyes on either side of their head, right? So maybe the exercise would be slightly different, but still, if they were...
No fingers either.
No fingers, yeah, they would have to do a fingerless version. But if they were to inquire into their original face, this goes across species, right? And then we might say, okay, what about before the first eyeballs? Even like, I think worms don't have eyes, but I think they have like a part of their worm skin is like receptive to light. I don't know it's biology so much, but I think there's something like that. There's some sensitivity to light. But even if there's not even sensitivity to light, if there's life itself, we're doing a visual exercise, but if you get the point of this, at some point you don't really even need the eyes to do it, right? It's a looking back at what is looking. Our original face before any eyeballs appeared on this planet, before anything we even call life. Now it starts to become very mysterious. We don't know. But anyway, this is original face, primordial, prehistoric face. And the head monk Ming said, going back to the story, I came for the Dharma, not for some robe. Like, I'm already wearing a robe, I don't need that Bodhidharma's robe. It's just symbolic stuff. But the Dharma is not symbolic stuff here. I came for the true Dharma with a capital D. So I beg you, please open the way, the true way for me. And the ancestor said, the way I'm spontaneously feeling like I could try to open the way for you is to say simply, without thinking about good and bad and color and shape, at this very moment, right now, not like theoretically, this very moment, literally the koan said, what is the original face of head monk Ming? Your original face. And something like it worked for me. He had a great realization. Satori just means to realize or to understand. And in Zen, it means like directly and experientially. And then sweat ran from his body. Sweat ran from his entire body. That was like a side effect of his satori. And maybe you could say it was that he had a new perspective, because he was so used to getting into the content of experience, which is called good and bad, and like that illiterate woodcutter shouldn't have gotten that robe so quickly, and it's bad. Put aside the bad thing just for the time being, because it's too distracting from our original face. And then once we clarify our original face, then we can re-engage like the issues of good and bad from a new perspective. We're less caught up in them. We're more flexible. The original face is infinitely flexible, because it includes everything equally. It includes good and bad equally. So then we can work with good and bad without projecting anything. So are you able to verify your original face, even for a moment? I think what happens is it's often for a moment, and then it's our original face. The problem with it is it's extremely boring, because there's nothing there. It's like it doesn't look like anything, and we're used to looking at things, so give me something to look at. Ooh, the smudges on the rug. We want some content around here. It's interesting. It's much more interesting than nothing. Who was it? Yun Men? Maybe? Ancestor said something like, no thing is better than a good thing. Classic Zen one-liner. Why is it better? Because it makes our whole body sweat. We have some understanding, we have some remembrance of who we really are. Because who we really are can't just be this temporary collection of colors and shapes and parts. Could it be that who we really are is the same as who our parents really are, and their parents, and those amoeba in the ocean? Who we really are is the same for all of us. And of course, that might lead to some sweat if we were really open to it, but it's good sweat. There's an interesting part of the story to throw in there. His whole body started to sweat. I think it's just maybe the shock of just, but I thought I was these hands and these feet and these eyes and these ears. Do you have any questions about this?
Well, what your exposition stimulated in me was when you look down the finger and you see the rug that mm-hmm. has a certain qualities, and you see, you know, Doralee and Karen and Jeff and so forth. You're seeing what you can attach to.
Yes. Yes.
But when you do this, you're actually seeing, or you, anyway, there's an intuition of what can't be attached to.
Very nice, yes.
What can't be attached to, and that is extremely encouraging.
Yes, thank you for that. Great point. There's many, many Dharma points come out of the simple exercise, right? And that's a very good one that we didn't talk about. That all of this, we can grasp it and reject it. The spots on the floor. With our mind, right? That's what we mean by attachment or grasping. We can stick to it, we can hold on to an idea of it, or we can reject our idea of it. But yeah, this one, our actual original face, we can't grasp it, and we can't attach to it, and we can't reject it. So again, this Zen sounds like it has lots of these paradoxes. Like, you can't find it, and you can't lose it. Well, that's impossible. Those are opposites. That's just a paradox. But if we look at our original face, you can't find it as some kind of thing, but also you can't lose it. You can forget about it very easily because it's so boring. Boring. But as soon as you look again, there it is. And even if you lose your eyesight and your hearing and all your senses, in fact, you don't lose this one. What about losing your life? Only one way to find out. And we will all get the opportunity. But my trust in original face, and considering this original face for a while, maybe it's a stupid, naive trust, but I trust that it doesn't go anywhere when we die. But the content that it's filled with, I think, will be quite different. And we can't even imagine what that might be. But the face in which everything appears, how could it, if it's the same as our great-great-great-grandparents' face, that means their face is right here, right now. Right? Our great-great-grandparents, their body, their legs and their torso are gone, but their original face, we see our great-grandparents' original face at the end of our finger right now. So we say they died, right? But their original face is right here. We're actually verifying their original face right now. Isn't that like a deathless face? Oh, Masker.
So are you discussing the nature of sentience and consciousness?
We could say it that way. Or something, could it be even deeper than sentience? But maybe something like this, because we could say, if there weren't knowing at all, then would there be this original face? Then it becomes more questionable. So,
but knowing and sentience are different, aren't they?
How would you say? I mean, partly how we define terms.
I mean by knowing, but yeah. I think sentience.
I don't mean conceptual knowing. I just mean cognizance, the fact that there is, that knowing knows that it is knowing.
Awareness of awareness.
Awareness of awareness.
But an but you said an amoeba has it, and I agree. But an amoeba is sentient. It responds, it has attraction, aversion, responses. That's the whole point of sentience, to sense things so we can act in our best interests.
Yeah, I don't know if that part would be needed, because that, that's we're now in the realm of grasping and rejecting, right?
I think an amoeba does that, but I don't know if it knows that in the way human does.
I would say it's not so much like, in order to maintain ourself, we need to kind of like absorb the good and reject the bad. That is part of sentient beings. I think so. That is the basic part of sentient beings. And then the Buddhas say, this is the problem, actually, is grasping and rejecting. Even if we don't, we say, the amoeba is really grasping and rejecting, but it's something like, if we don't call it grasping and rejecting, I would say it's like a precursor of that for their survival. So, but then we hear, then there's Buddhas that are like, really are not grasping and rejecting at all. So that we could ask, are they more primitive than amoebas? Or is it, no, it's a different kind of thing. They're just like, or we could ask it, could there be that there is an original face that is actually not grasping and rejecting, and it doesn't need, if we say sentience is this kind of very primitive grasping and rejecting, maybe there can be an original face that's not sentient in that kind of way. Yeah. And we can't imagine that because we're sentient beings.
You made the point, which I appreciated, that we temporarily, or maybe put in abeyance, the grasping and rejecting.
And in order to verify or rediscover our obvious original face. Yeah.
In order to discover, in order to express.
Maybe express it, we maybe can then re-engage the world of differences, right? Expression.
Right, so maybe Buddhas are in that same position of really, because I think, as humans, we can't, it's in the genome, aversion and an attraction.
A genome?
Are in the genome.
In the genome.
They're genetic. They're hardwired. Mm-hmm. They're part of amoebas and humans.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this really mysterious thing about being able to kind of step aside from that.
Or we might say it's like, the Buddhas talk about this life is kind of like a dream, right? So it might be like, there's a dream of grasping and rejecting, but if a Buddha is lucid in that dream, or a bodhisattva is lucid in that dream, then they can see, it looks that way, but actually, it's not really like that. Like, so with this exercise again, you could say another part of the description is there's color and shape and distinction and array of differences out there at the end of the outward facing finger, and also all the preferences of good and bad and so on are out there, but at this finger there's strictly speaking, there's no preferences there, and actually nothing's even happening. There's also no movement or anything happening, and this is the ray of movement. So it could be that we're in touch with both. A bodhisattva or a Buddha could be nothing's actually happening from the point of view of the original face, and yet, like in a dream, this dream stuff is not actually happening to the sleeper, but it appears like a lot is happening for the dream body.
Okay, one more possibility. This finger is pointing at the world, we see it as an individual, but really we're just part of this enterprise called life. And in that context, our coming and going is all perfect. It's part of the whole scheme that this finger somehow recognizes.
Well, there's something about like we're sort of discovering how we're sharing the same original face, because we point back like this, again, we're going to see a different side of a nose, each of us, right? A slightly different nose, but we're not so interested in that. That's more of the content, right? We're interested in what about the space in which this half nose is floating? And that space, mustn't it be identical for all of us? So then we have this strange thing. It's like we share one original face, but the sentient beings are located, so our view of what's happening is different, and we're having conversations in the room, but you could say from the point of view of the original face, there's no interaction and nothing happening, and it's just this play through all these different so-called eyeballs.
There's no place you can hide, because it's all one thing.
It's all one thing, yeah. And it's not even from the point of view of our original face, right? We can't even say, from its perspective, there's not even, like, there's a bunch of interdependent people and things, right? There's actually no thing. That's why they say in Buddhism, emptiness, they call it emptiness, where they say there's no arising or ceasing. There's nothing happening, actually, right, in emptiness. But then out there, that's in the conventional truth, that's the realm of interdependent appearances. And then we say the appearances, the dependently arising appearances and the emptiness are called the conventional truth and the ultimate truth. And they're not synonyms, but there's no dividing line between them. Okay, that's good.
So, Zazen is the practice of experiencing one's original face.
Could be.
Well, maybe we let.
If you're lucky.
We experience everything without latching on to anything.
And the way it
leads. And that's doing both of these at the same time.
Yeah. And also, we can do the practice of, you know, noticing that the mind is grasping something and then saying, oh, I'm holding on, just let go. That would be like a practice. But I would propose we could do that practice over and over again without necessarily verifying our original face. And it's still a great practice, but it's kind of an intentional practice. It's more like, I'm these legs and this torso, this person that likes to grasp onto ideas and things, and like, oh, there I go. And we know it's painful to do it. So there I go, just let go. And all that could happen without verifying our original face in this intentional way that a person can, with intentions, can do that kind of practice. But this other way is kind of like, see if we can remember our original face, and then it already is not grasping anything. So it's more like, naturally, the grasping tendency relaxes when remembering our original face. You see how they're slightly different practices. They're both about letting go of grasping, but one's like, I'm letting go of grasping, and I have to keep doing it, because the grasping keeps coming up. And the other one is more like, there's just this original face that's already not grasping, and then the so-called person is naturally appearing in this window, so they it's more of a, without any intention, the grasping just drops away. Which, for those who know the Platform Sutta of the Six Ancestors, there's these two poems. One is about, like, polishing the mirror again and again. You can see that's like grasping coming up, polish it. Dust on the mirror, polish it. And the other, yeah, and then the other poem is from the Six Ancestors. It says, well, in this original face, there's no place for any dust anyway, so we don't have to intentionally let go. That would be one way to hear it. But it's subtle, right? And it's hard to remember our original face because it's so boring. But the more we stay with it, the more we see what seems boring is actually miraculous. And it's naturally letting go. Yes, thank you. Yes.
So this is, I've always wondered how this group of little people that plays this game.
Yeah.
So the mother is holding the baby, and I'm standing behind the baby, and we look eyes. So now, the baby has my attention, and I have the baby's attention, and then cycle over to the right, or the left, or down, as close as if the baby can see, probably closer to maybe what the original
is. Yeah, yeah, uh-huh.
So I call that pinky blue. I mean, I think you just explained to me this game that all babies, you know, 12 months, 18 months, what we play. For 18 months, we probably a little bit later. But through this game, and it's just.
Yeah.
It's and a game of knowing. It is a universal game between them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
They're
seeing other faces, and they're also, but they're exploring very freely themselves and others in this way, and it reminds me of I think it's this Douglas Harding, who's the one who came up with this rediscovery of headlessness. His student Richard Lang talks about humans growing up, and he's saying there's these stages of a newborn infant is just their original face, and that they don't really make a distinction. They don't make this distinction between themselves and the world. If we're doing this right now, we look for a distinction, we can't find one. We might call it, if we really are clear about this exercise, we could call it Satori if we really grok that. But the newborn infant is naturally like that, right? And then as they get older, and I think it's, I don't know all the numbers, but something like maybe 4 months earlier than what you're speaking about, they start to get told by their parents that actually you are this body. And then the parents will even show them in a mirror and like see that the thing in the mirror there, that's you. It's not really them. But they start getting the training. And over, you know, something like between 4 months and maybe 12 months or something, they start to forget their original face, basically. And as themselves, as who they really are, as their true nature, and start to identify with the face in the mirror or the body, because they keep getting told. You gotta start identifying with that. And we do have to start to function in the world. We do have to start identifying with the body as an individual. But then we lose touch with our original face.
They're good at it.
The babies?
They're really good at it.
Yeah.
It's
one of the things they do. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Yes, I keep coming back to the pointing in your exercise, and I heard one time that the pointing is what makes us human.
Mm. Babies do that too.
Because it enables us to draw the attention of a group of individuals to a single object.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we do with intention,
mm-hmm.
and it's a volitional act.
Yeah.
All of our troubles begin.
I think that's right. We have these like narrow, long, pointy things, and this, as you said, we use them to point at particular objects and get everybody and to look at the objects.
Yes, but we never point at ourselves.
Yeah, or even particularly all the other things like that. So we say In Zen, we have that phrase too. Eko Henjo means in Japanese term for turning the light around and shining back. That's Eko Henjo. The light of pointing, our attention is pointed outwards. So we say turn that light around and shine it back, which is exactly this exercise, I would say. This is using a visual kind of game here, but that's what it is. And it's hard to do because we're so used to pointing at objects with our attention and our finger. Sorry.
I might take us far astray if I ask my question, so maybe I'll defer.
Save it for the afternoon. You can continue.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, from this space, something happens.
Yes, from this space, something appears to happen. Mm-hmm. In fact, everything that happens, happens from and in and as the space. Yeah. Right. So, depending on which kind of school of Buddhism we're speaking of, like for say Nagarjuna's middle way, he talks about emptiness and the stuff that's happening. But he, I think, doesn't really use this. Maybe it's a slightly different perspective because he wouldn't say everything is happening from emptiness. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say Nagarjuna, we talked about. But other schools of Buddhism, more like the like Yogacara and Tathagata Garbha, these other kind of schools without getting into these philosophies, they would, I think, talk more like everything is arising from this space. I see it. From this space, just that's how it seems right now, right? And it's arising in this space, and it's arising as the space. If we say as the space, that's the most kind of, I would say, most non-dual expression. And that's what this exercise is about. Can we find any dividing line between the space of our original face and everything that's happening? Like, no, there's no dividing line. They're actually like, what's happening is the space. What's happening? It's the world is happening as our original face. We usually think the other way. We usually think the world is happening to me. That's a very dualistic way. I'm over here, like, in this body, or something like that. And the world out there is happening to me. That's kind of called duality. But this is more like, I'm not this body. The body is actually happening in me. Who is me? The original face. And this lap and this torso are happening, called the body, and the feelings in the body also are happening in our original face as the expression of our original face.
Expression,
you could say, mm-hmm. Or more directly, as our original face. Just like the Heart Sutra is so direct, form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself is form. You could say this exercise is a commentary on the Heart Sutra too. Our original face is emptiness. There's nothing there to grasp. And but what about all these forms? Well, they are our original face. There's no distinction between them. Emptiness, particularly, emptiness itself, literally, is form. Yes.
You mentioned earlier, you know, it operates even without senses. Mm-hmm. You have no hearing, you have no smell, or sight, or whatever. But the image that came to mind, or the thing that came to mind was Helen Keller.
Yeah.
Her description of her first awareness of, you know, coming out of this infancy illness that she had that caused her to be blind and deaf and mute, and then having no sense of anything other than just
tactile.
I need.
And also,
you know, and
physical
I
feeling.
It, and I get it, and whatever, until her teacher helped her understand that there, you know, there are names for things, and that it's not, you know, whatever it is. And there's something beyond just, oh, I'm hungry, or whatever, you know. Mm. Just, and she said it was like, you know, some, I forget how she described it, but it was just.
And there's some relationship there,
yeah,
with her teachers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Suddenly she was free to recognize that she was not just herself in her, locked in herself.
Or herself being like, her bodily needs or something like that. Yeah, yeah. So her original face is actually our original face.
Yeah.
And so therefore we know that it doesn't need all the senses.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think using the visual sense, that's what's, you know, is a little, it's a fun sort of game. But I think it's just helpful because our senses are a huge part of our life. So to do these exercises, It's a little bit limited, but I think what it points to, no pun intended, is something very profound that doesn't rely on the senses. This is, yeah, probably.
Yeah, when you're doing this exercise, in the beginning you said that you said the label maybe usefulness, I'm not sure if you said it, but to let go of a sense of good and bad in collaboration.
Yes.
Right. And then maybe this pointing. And at some point, like, I was doing this, but I started just doing this. And I couldn't tell at some point. It's very mundane, actually. The gap between the distinction between this and all of this go away.
That's right.
And from there, for some reason, I don't know what reason I thought, the good and bad came, and just love came. But when the distinctions, so, or as I was listening to you now, or saying of all these things, it came to me that, like, we say, what's the verification? But it came to me that actually I've always been from the love to the wisdom, but this is the other way. And the verification of wisdom is love.
Yeah, you could say that they're inseparable, really.
Inseparable, yeah, I know, but for the first time I saw the other way.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You entered it through the wisdom side.
So,
yeah. And the reason we could call this love, I think we could define true love, is just
no distinction,
exactly. Yeah. Not reifying separation and distinction. I think that's a simple way of talking about love. And that's what our original face is like. Yeah. It can still see distinctions, but it doesn't believe that they are the deepest reality. So let's leave it at this for now, because we have another talk this afternoon. We can continue on this theme and finish the koan.
So, Jim, we have 15 minutes. Should we do keying, or should we do a sitting period?
We have sitting period, and then we have Kenyan now, and then we'll do a short sitting period. I believe service is at 12:10.
Oh, okay.
Actually, it says 12 here, but
12.
But maybe we could do it at 12:10 to give me time to meet with someone.
Okay.
Or a little bit late, so we
yeah,
can have a little sitting.
So we'll have Kenyan and a short sitting while Kokyo meets with someone.
In 12:10.
We'll tell time, we'll sit through service.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is Zazen, I should say. You're welcome, if you'd like, to enjoy your original face while sitting Zazen. It's boring, but try it.